and welcome everybody to Scottish Independence Podcast. This week we are looking at Scotland's renewable energy potential, or powerhouse as we're titling this show. We've got the help of Dr. Craig Diehl, who's the Policy Director of Commonweal. And Craig is one of our favourite guests on the show, not least because he patiently answers all the questions that we put to him.
Scotland has so much in the way of energy, renewable energy resources. How would we best use them if we were independent? Or even how could we best or better use them at the moment when we're still not independent? As often as we see comments on social media about Wales is setting up an energy company, why can't Scotland?
Before we bring Craig on, let's just remind ourselves that for the second time, the recent SNP conference, there was a motion put up, this time it was Chris Law, that we should have a publicly owned energy company in Scotland. It didn't get progressed the first time. And if you look on ScotGov, it just says we didn't think now was the time.
Rather an unfortunate phrase to use.
Yes, indeed. The plot thickens a little bit. Bill Ramsey put up an amendment to Chris Law's motion. I'm paraphrasing. We know we're not allowed to own a publicly owned energy company in Scotland, but there's other things we can do. There's other ways we can do it. But that was the point I thought, oh, what do you mean we're not allowed to do it? Not only is now not the time, we also don't have the legal ability to do it,
yeah.
Which is a different situation, isn't it?
It is. We also need to understand the difference between talking about a Scottish publicly owned energy company and, say, a Scottish publicly owned electricity company. And that's what's going to get unravelled and then clarified by Craig in this conversation. One thing to add, I'm not actually there as part of the conversation, because at the point where we'd set up to meet with Craig, I was really out of it with a really bad cough and chest thing. And well, I'll not give you the details, you don't want to know them, but I'm a little bit better now. But last week, I'll tell you, I was like a croaky frog, wasn't I?
Don't worry, Marlene did put her tuppence worth in all the way through the editing process. Our first question for Craig was, how come Wales can do it if we can't?
Probably a starting point from the Welsh angle is the Scottish independence referendum. After the NDREF, there was the discussions about, okay, Scotland hasn't voted for independence, but we did promise them more powers in some respect. Let's get together and discuss what that could look like. This resulted in the Smith Commission, if folk remember this, which came up with a package of proposals for powers. That then evolved into the Scotland Act 2017. Simultaneously to that, Wales was also renegotiating its equivalent, the Wales Act. Those negotiations were not operating in synchrony. There was not really any sort of cross-collaboration between Scotland and Wales on this, and there was no real desire actually from Westminster to come up with a coherent package. Devolution in the UK is very asymmetrical, they call it. The powers that are granted to the provinces are sort of scattergun and almost dependent on how much of a nuisance that region is towards Westminster.
No.
If you can create a bit more attention, you can get a few more sweeties to shut you up. But there's definitely no coordination in this. So in general, while the Scotland Act gives more devolution to the Scottish Parliament than the Welsh Parliament, there are some differences where Wales does pull ahead. Mm-hmm. And one of those is in public energy. So in that round of negotiation around 2016-2017, Wales was given the explicit power for the Welsh government to create a body that could own electricity generation within Wales. In Scotland, it goes the other way. The Scottish government is explicitly prohibited from owning electricity generation in Scotland. So it is interesting wording there. Now, the Act was written almost a quarter century ago now, over a quarter century ago now. So it's a bit out of date in this respect, but it does explicitly prohibit the Scottish government, I'll get to that distinction in a moment, from owning anything that generates, transmits or stores electricity. Now, I'd like to query that a bit, because that, does that mean that the Scottish government is not allowed to put solar panels on the roofs of government buildings?
No.
Because they generate electricity. How about the batteries in the stationery cupboard?
When you think of it like that, it's ridiculous, isn't it?
Yeah, the law is quite black and white, but possibly a bit too black and white in that respect. Mm. So Wales was given the power to create this public energy company. The cooperation agreement between the Labour government and Plaid Cymru in Wales created the political momentum to start this, you know, representatives from that group called us and asked if they could take Commonweal's plan for a public energy company, and they've adapted it to their circumstances. It looks like that's now going ahead. The Welsh government's going to start building publicly owned renewable energy on public land in Wales.
Using your plan, how does that make you feel?
It's possibly Commonweal's biggest political success, and it's not in Scotland, which is a bit strange. But it kind of does show our influence that even when we can't get traction in the Scottish government where we're aiming, you know, other people are watching our campaigns.
Could we get Wales to supply us with energy?
Could we get the Welsh government to set up the Welsh energy company in Scotland? Well, technically, probably yes, but I would argue against it for the same reason that I would argue against the Danish public energy companies or the Norwegian public energy companies owning even more of our energy generation than they already do. Because where do the profits go from that energy? It would flow out of Scotland.
Yes, absolutely. And that is, you know, one of the big questions with all this is who is making money from our renewables?
Exactly.
You know, and it doesn't seem to be us. It does seem, I mean, you've got Vattenfall, which is what, Swedish, you've got Statkraft, Norwegian, you've got, oh, you name it, other countries, EDF, yeah. Nationalized by the French. It kind of seems to me like, you know, if I grew potatoes in my garden and somebody comes along and says, I'll dig those up for you, digs them up, then sells them back to me, and I make nothing out of it. It's infuriating the more you think of it.
Yeah, and that's before we go into the problem of the private companies who are extracting the profits as well. But yeah, it's a bizarre situation that any government on the planet can own energy generation in Scotland, except the government of Scotland.
Except ours. Do we have any options?
There are ways that Scotland can get around this restriction.
Because
the Scotland Act is very specific that the Scottish government is not allowed to own electricity generation. Now, there's two ways of getting around that clause. The first is, don't have the Scottish government own the electricity generators. Mm. And you can do that because you could set up regional energy companies. So each local authority could own an energy company, and there have been local authorities in Scotland that have owned energy companies. One recent example was Aberdeen, that owned some offshore wind turbines until the Conservative councillors there decided that they weren't interested in public ownership and sold them off. So that's possible. So you could, every local authority could own its own electricity company. We could have community energy, of course, and that's been a growing thing in Scotland, where local communities own their own energy generation and try to become self-sufficient that way. We could do what's called a public-public partnership, not a public-private partnership, which people might be familiar with. But a public-public partnership is where you get two areas of the public sector collaborating together. So perhaps a local authority and a community working together to generate electricity. There's also another model which I quite like, which is the mutual model. So we could set up a Scottish national energy company that is a private company, but the shareholders are Scottish residents. It's set up constitutionally so that every Scottish resident owns one share in this company. You can't sell it, you can't trade it. If you move out of Scotland, you lose it. But then that makes us all shareholders in the national energy company.
I like that idea. That's a bit like the old co-op, how it used to work when we all had that co-op.
Very, very similar to that. And again, there's been examples of that in British history as well. There's a gas company in Northern Ireland that's constituted on that. The customers are the owners.
Yeah. And is Scottish Water similar to that?
Scottish Water is different. It's a private company that's owned by Scottish ministers.
That's right. So which they wouldn't be allowed to do if it's electricity because of the
Scottish. Yeah. So that deals with the Scottish government is not allowed to own bit of the national energy company. Mm-hmm. But we can also look at the other side of it, not allowed to own an electricity generating company.
Oh, so what can we own?
This is where the Scotland Act really shows its obsolescence, because there's other forms of energy. One of the things that we've been really advocating for is to look at exactly how much energy we need, not just electricity. Now, if you look at Scotland's energy mix, roughly speaking, about 25% of our energy demand is electricity for our lights and electrical utilities. Mm-hmm. About 25% is transport, the fuel for our cars. About 50% of Scotland's energy demand is heat. Scotland could have a national heat company that delivers heat to houses.
Because heat's not reserved.
Not gas, because heat's not reserved. How would you do this? This is where heat networks come in. District heating systems, they are ubiquitous across Europe. They're almost unknown in the UK. We're over a century behind in this method of generating heat. In fact, a good example I like to use, if you're an aficionado of early 20th century detective noir movies, and you see the old gumshoe walking through the back alleys of New York, and you see the steam rising from the manholes, that's a district heating system. So these are common around the place. So one of the issues that Scotland has in its energy transition is, how do we transition away from using oil and gas for heating? How do we transition away from using petrol for cars? Yeah. Now, remember that ratio I just said there. If we transitioned all of our transport to electricity and we didn't have any savings because we were doing public transport better, or just the general efficiency of EVs over petrol, well, if 25% of our energy use goes from petrol and diesel to electricity, we've just doubled our electricity demand.
Yeah.
If we then take all of the gas and oil boilers in Scotland and we turn them into electric heating, and again, we don't get any savings from efficiency because we're not insulating homes, or you ignore the fact that electric heat pumps are more efficient than an electric boiler, then you've just doubled energy demand again. Yeah. You would need to increase the number of wind turbines in Scotland by a factor of four to meet all this demand. If you just think of the actual engineering challenge of doubling the electricity demand and doubling it again almost, you know, that's going to need a lot more in the way of reinforcement to the national grid. It's going to need a lot more pylons and cables everywhere. We're going to need that anyway, because we're transitioning from a model that was basically based around having coal and gas power plants in the south of England to having wind turbines in the north of Scotland. Yeah. We're going to have to do that reinforcement. However, the national grid itself is reserved. So the Scottish government can't do that kind of reinforcement itself.
I live in Clackmannanshire, and I was looking at their energy plan, which is part of the city deal with Stirling. And in the 320 pages of the plan, there is a page about energy generation, but it is so small scale. They're literally looking at what fields does the council own that it could put probably a PV array they're talking about. And then they're possibly talking about having a private wire from that to a nearby business or to a nearby school or something. I mean, it's great that they're looking at these things.
That kind of thing is going to be useful in very remote areas of Scotland. I hate that language. Areas where Edinburgh is remote from. You know, the people who live in rural Scotland are fine just where they are. Everywhere else is far away. So especially in the islands, again, where the challenges of connecting islands to the mainland grid are present. But the point is, if Scotland can't reinforce the grid to match the speed of our electricity transition, why are we pushing electricity as the model of that transition? The Scottish government's approach to heat transition is largely based on electrically powered air source heat pumps. And as I say, they are a bit more efficient than, say, an electric combi boiler or an electric immersion heater. But it's still going to add a lot of electricity demand to the grid. And the grid can't cope. We can't transition that demand any faster than the British government, Westminster, will transition the grid. The way around that is to push as much of the demand as we can off of the electricity grid, which is, again, why we want to see the massive expansion of district heat networks. If we're delivering heat through steam or hot water directly to houses, then we don't need to supply them with electricity or gas, and we can build that infrastructure using devolved powers.
Ah, right. So what is powering that, then, if it's not electricity or gas?
Well, various ways of doing it. The one that we are really interested in is one that's starting to roll out in Denmark, where you get a large water reservoir. Scotland actually has quite a few water reservoirs that we no longer use for drinking water that might be ideal for this. You cover it over, you insulate it, and then you use renewable electricity, you use wind power, you use solar thermal not solar PV, but solar thermal power to heat up that water reservoir. If you do this, solar thermal panels are actually cheaper than solar PV, if you do it right. And solar PV panels are really cheap these days. But you use that, if you're not allowed to own electricity generators, you use the solar thermal generators to generate the heat directly. You store that heat during the summer, using our very long summer days, store that heat in the reservoir. Then in the winter, when we need that energy, we can take it back out. There's also other schemes like using old mines, old flooded coal mines.
Yeah, that was something we looked at in where I live, because there was a new housing estate, actually, and they looked into whether the mines could be used as a district heating for that housing estate, which was great. Yeah. They were looking at. Turned out, though, the mines weren't where they thought they were. you're dealing with 18th century maps.
Yeah, so that's a big resource. There's other resources like extracting heat from river water. There's a scheme being piloted to use the Clyde for this. Or you can use ocean water for the same purpose. There's various ways of generating that heat. You can even use waste heat from industries. In fact, a lot of countries in Europe where they have district heating, it's a legal duty for waste heat to be fed into the local district heating system.
Yeah, and I think that was part of the heating and buildings consultation, which I did the other day.
Yes.
I was looking at Berwick Bank, the proposal for a huge wind farm that's going to supply 37% of Scotland's offshore wind target is going to come from that.
Yeah.
But you look at where the energy is coming, they've got two connections to the grid, and one of them's in Northumberland. So already that's bypassing Scotland completely. I don't think they realise how offensive some of these things are, but there was an advert, I think it was to do with the grid itself, and they said, you know, we're moving the energy from where it's generated with this vague sort of wave at the north somewhere to where it's needed, and you've got all these, the southeast coast all lit up. And you think, hang on a minute, that is our country giving it to your country for free. It's just infuriating. We were at the workshop that Yes for EU did, and Sam Page did a session on interconnectors, and it really is quite an eye-opener that the only one Scotland's got is a very short one to Northern Ireland, and everything else is from England to various places in Europe, and it takes 10 years to build one. Here's a clip from one of the National Grid adverts, and when they say UK, they mean England.
We already have interconnectors connecting the UK to France, Belgium, Norway, and the Netherlands. And we have another interconnector to Denmark in the works.
And what about the EU's net zero strategy?
If we want to decarbonize our economies and be less dependent on imported oil and gas, we have to increase the share of electricity in our energy mix. Electric cars, electric heat pumps in our homes and offices, electric boilers in our heating systems, manufacturing powered by electricity. The European Union totally gets this. They want electricity to be 3/4 of our energy mix by 2050.
You would think that we would be so welcomed back in the EU as a source of energy if they just had an interconnector. I mean, it's bizarre that it's
we actually did a bit of research, and sadly we never published it, but looking at the potential for Scotland coming back into the EU, and especially looking at where our strengths lie in negotiations. Because if you go into the EU and you just kind of rush it, you against the Scottish Government approach, we will just sign any bit of paper the EU gives us so that we can get back in quickly. They'll give you the worst possible deal. And this has been seen in acceding countries. If you have something to offer the EU, you can negotiate a much better deal from the EU. It's very back and forth that way. So what does Scotland have to offer? Well, it is energy. So we could be building an energy strategy to help reinforce the EU's energy demands. And I have seen proposals, for example, linking up Scottish offshore wind to Icelandic geothermal and Norwegian hydroelectric pumped storage. And you create a kind of mega grid in that triangle. Now, that's glossing over a lot of the technical issues and the political issues. Norway in particular isn't exactly keen to see its resources taken from it in exactly the same way. But the overall point is, if Scotland has a strategy to provide energy and to use that, then we can negotiate a good deal from it. Even things like the current Scottish Government's hydrogen plan, which is based on an interconnector to ship hydrogen, I think, to Germany. But it's all based on private companies extracting profits and extracting the wealth. So it's not benefiting Scotland doing it that way.
So how does Scotland get a fair return on its assets? That Berwick Bank, that was the thing, that the impression I got. I mean, they were saying things like, oh, it'll power 6 million houses, and that's twice as much as Scotland's energy generation. And yeah, if we buy it from you, you know, it's not going to power it out because it's ours. But they were talking about potential in the supply chain. That was the only bit that you could actually see money flowing into Scotland, is through whatever bits they could pick up in the supply chain.
Yeah, and we've seen that in other areas of energy development. Folk familiar with me and my work will know about my campaign around the ScotWind project, the massive offshore wind project that's been approved. And the Scottish Government was touting the supply chain benefits of this programme. But when you actually go in and look at the numbers, it's less than a third of the total investment is happening in Scotland. So it's elsewhere that's going to benefit far more from this project than here. And even the promises that were made in that project, they were backed up with the potential for penalties and fines if those promises weren't realised. But the fines were so low. You know, in a lot of cases, it would be cheaper to pay the fine and break the promise than to keep the promise. So it's almost incentivising those promises to be broken.
For goodness sake. Can I ask about GB Energy, this proposed publicly owned energy company allegedly cited in Scotland that Starmer's talking about? What's your thoughts on that?
We don't actually know much about it yet. This is the problem. The promises of it have been very vague. We don't really know exactly how much it will own or what it'll do. I mean, there's various ways you could do this. And actually, one that we've been advocating the Scottish Government does is instead of offering subsidies and grants and loans to companies to build renewable energy, you should be buying an equity stake in them. So you should be becoming a shareholder in those groups. And that seems to be what GB Energy wants to do, wants to become a shareholder within a larger investment scheme. So it would still be a private company that owns it, but there would be some public money and a bit of public ownership and a bit of the returns coming back to the public purse, which is fine. But it's not the same as an actual energy company like Vattenfall or Ørsted doing the work, actually employing people on behalf of the Scottish or the British public to build and maintain and run the energy company. It does look as if GB Energy is going to be more of that investment vehicle, which probably suits Keir Starmer.
Presumably,
would be a proper sort of post-war socialist labour rebuilding exercise.
Yeah, well, there's not much socialist about the Labour Party these days. The public purse in question also is going to be Westminster's public purse, isn't it? It's not going to be Scotland's. It did occur to me that they're setting it up as a threat, so that if we look as if we're getting close to independence, oh, but you'll lose your GB Energy company, all those jobs will go. You know, it just seems more like a bargaining chip to me. But
I mean, it's exactly the same way the old Green Investment Bank was. The Green Investment Bank was set up specifically as a if you vote for independence, you'll lose it. And then as soon as they could get away with it after the independence referendum, it was sold off and broken up.
What did you think of the debate where Graham McCormack, who's been a regular guest of ours, he had this very intriguing idea that you could tax pipelines? This was his contribution at the last SNP conference.
Energy is largely reserved to Westminster, but the heritable assets of the energy companies in this country, including all the tanking, the trunking, the piping, is actually can be taxed by the Scottish Parliament and government now. I've also discovered that Unlike other heritable assets, whether it's property or land, and some aspects of land which are rated under non-domestic rates legislation, we specifically exclude pipes and cables. Why? There is nothing in law that says that we cannot tax them, and it would be a fairly simple and straightforward thing in order to bring forward a piece of legislation very quickly which could address that. Because to put it in context, the excess profits from the energy companies from Scotland alone is probably something around £10 billion a year. From government, UK and Scottish government statistics, the estimated total energy bill for Scottish consumers is about £6 billion a year. And if we actually look at all the pipes and cables which these companies have, then if they were taxed on £57 per metre length, that would raise £6.5 billion a year.
It's a very left field kind of thing, but...
Potentially, although I would say that the transmission market, the electricity transition market in the UK and the retail market in the UK are actually pretty heavily regulated in terms of the profits they extract. The profits that the retail companies extract from your bill are actually already razor thin. They're not allowed to take much. The reason your electricity bills have been going up is because of the energy generators. It's the people who actually own the turbines or the gas plants, mostly the gas plants, that have been pushing those prices up and extracting profits that way. So taxing the wires, taxing the new pylons, I mean, it might have a place if it was a very local municipal tax, in the sense that we understand that if there's an onshore wind turbine near your community, then it attracts some sort of community benefit fund that can be fed into your community. I live in South Lanarkshire. I'm surrounded by onshore wind turbines, and there's a lot of community money that comes from them. It's not easy to use, not easy to access, and there's not a lot of people who know how to navigate that system, so it's not well used, but it's there. However, there's going to be areas, particularly in the Highlands, where there's going to be large banks of ScotWind offshore energy coming onshore and then being transmitted down south. Either to the rest of Scotland or further down south than that. Now, what is the benefit to a community who maybe has to put up with the pylon next to them but doesn't have the generator next to them? So there's maybe some kind of scope for a community benefit fund for that kind of thing. But as I say, there's not really an obvious profit mechanism there from which to take the community benefit fund. The amount of money is kind of thin, so you might have to start thinking about rather than taxing the transmission infrastructure itself, looking again back at the generators and charging them for the generation. So it's a complex area there.
It's a tricky one, isn't it?
Yeah. That's not to discount the thing that these communities that are going to be in the flight path, as it were, for the electricity transition, because the UK energy grid is having to almost flip north south. We've probably all seen those graphs about the connection charges that are charged when a generator is put into the grid. And the reason that that is set up that way, that's set up so that if you build your energy generator near London, you don't pay much of a connection charge. You might even get a subsidy to connect in. Whereas if you put that same connector in the north of Scotland, you have to pay quite a lot to connect it to the grid. And the reason that that's the case is quite simple. When that system was set up, transmitting electricity was quite expensive. Transmitting coal by train was very cheap. So the incentive was to build your coal power plant near your population centres. But this isn't the case now. You can't transport the wind by rail. We're going to have to flip the grid to where the resources are, as you mentioned before. So it is going to mean much more transmission infrastructure in the north of Scotland, whether that's above ground pylons or underground cables or some other system. It's going to have to happen, and communities that are in the path of these plans are we're going to have discussions about how that happens.
And how do we store all this energy? And you've also got the situation where the Scottish turbines are being switched off when the grid is full, or, you know, when it can't take in any more. And so, and yet you've still got people living potentially underneath the turbine in fuel poverty.
Yeah.
The turbine's not, you know, you'd think there'd be some way of, if you've got spare capacity, feeding it into communities roundabout who need it, whether by private wires or whatever, would seem to be the fair thing to do. But I don't know.
There's a couple of issues there. One is those connection grid charges and transmission charges I'm very much oversimplifying here, but it's almost charged as if the electricity is being sent to London and then sent back up to Scotland.
Yeah.
Right. It's not quite that. But what you can't do is put up a turbine next to your community, connect it into the grid, but then benefit from the proximity that you have to that.
Yeah.
It's quite complex to try and get that local benefit from it. And there have been people proposing a much more local charging scheme. So if you are in an area of high supply, then you should maybe get a discount in the demand that you take off, because that's
yeah, you're helping them store it, really, aren't you?
Well, you're helping them use it before it's feeding into transmission bottlenecks. Storage is another issue. When we've been building this energy transition, we've been focusing, quite rightly because of cost, mostly on wind. But wind alone, without storage, does lead to periods where you have oversupply and under demand. There's ways of doing that, ways of getting around that. One is build storage, build batteries. That has its own issues. There are communities, I know, my community is one of them, where there are proposals to build giant containers, banks of shipping containers full of quite volatile batteries that may have some impact, especially if they catch fire. Where are the community benefits in having those built near you? Another way of doing it is to move us all over to much more flexible energy tariffs. I myself am on an electricity tariff that changes every half hour. And sometimes when it's particularly windy, my electricity fee goes negative. So I get paid to put on the tumble dryer. The converse is, when energy demand is high, like at tea time, it can be quite expensive to put the oven on. So you have to balance this. You maybe have to change your behavior. Or if we had batteries, we could store energy. We could store electricity when we're getting paid to use it, and then take it out of the battery when the price goes up again.
Yeah. When I drive an electric car, I'm driving a battery. I kind of think, how could I not just get a little cell on the garage roof that charges the battery up instead of me having to go to the EV charge point? But you think of the number of people that are driving electric cars. If the council sort of went, right, electricity's free from 8 till 10 because that's when it's over, so your tumble dryer example, we all go and fill up our cars, we're taking it off the grid.
There have been schemes that even go further than that look at cars as a battery resource themselves. So if you've got your car plugged in overnight and then there's an unexpected spike in demand because, I don't know, say a nuclear power plant had to switch off suddenly, then those batteries could feed back into the grid, and the car owners would be charged. It would be given a payment for that. The downside of that, though, is nobody really wants to wake up in the morning to find they can't get to work because their car battery's dead, because the grid needed the power. No matter how much I pay you overnight, you still can't get to work that day. That's a problem. So I'm not convinced about that model. Go the on. Other way of balancing that variability in wind, of course, is to have more diverse renewable energy. Studies have been done where solar power, as you mentioned, on rooftops or on brownfield sites. We're seeing a lot of these solar panels go into greenfield sites. A lot of farmers are being paid a lot of money to put up solar panels. Yeah. It's an issue in my local area. That I'm not for, but on brownfield sites or other derelict land or land that's maybe on uplands that's not so useful for agriculture, but certainly on rooftops, if we had more solar panels, there's an interesting correlation between solar and wind. When it's windy, it's generally cloudy. When it's not windy, it's generally sunny, even in Scotland. Right now, I look out my window, there's not much wind, but there's plenty of blue sky. So having wind and solar together do tend to back each other up. There aren't that many days in the year where it's neither sunny nor windy. You get the foggy December mornings, and that's an issue.
Stick a bit of tidal in there as well,
and stick a bit of tidal in. Stick a bit of the geothermal or your heat pumps, drawing the energy from the mines, and stick in some batteries, and suddenly you have a balanced grid that's entirely renewable.
What do you think Scotland should be doing now to get a better deal? Reduce people's bills, take control of whatever way we can of our own resources. Is there anything we can do under the current settlement, or does it all have to wait until all doors open when we're independent?
The biggest constraint that Scotland has is in our capital borrowing limits. Scotland is not allowed to borrow enough money to make the transition, and that's just true no matter what the strategy is. So that needs the fiscal framework for Scotland needs to be aggressively renegotiated. Now, unfortunately, last year there was a scheduled renegotiation on the fiscal framework, and quite frankly, the Scottish Government botched it. All they managed to get out of that was that the capital borrowing limits for Scotland would be uprated by inflation from now on. So all that was saying is our capital borrowing limits will no longer decrease. They're not going to get bigger in real terms. So we just don't have enough money to do this transition. Obviously, if we became independent, that problem entirely goes away, especially if we've got our own currency. If we decide to keep the pound for an extended period of time, then we've got a different problem. But so that's the bottleneck. We need the ability to borrow. If we can't do it from the Scottish Government, then we need to look at things like the Scottish National Investment Bank and free it from the Scottish Government's capital borrowing limits. That's probably an entirely different discussion. But let's say we do it. Let's say we can get the money. What do we need to do? First thing I would say is demand reduction. The most efficient unit of energy is the one you don't need. Right, so that means insulation for houses, that means more efficient electric cars, and also fewer of them. It means much better public transport, it means more car sharing, more active travel, right? We are being forced to pay for our own transition in our houses. You know, we're having to pay out of pocket for insulation and for air source heat pumps, and it's very expensive, which means nobody can afford to do it. That just shouldn't be. That we need to do this transition as a matter of public works. In the days when we transitioned from having an outhouse to an indoor toilet, we weren't asked to go and dig a trench to lay some pipe to connect our own little private bit of the sewage network.
Exactly. Or even get your Wi-Fi, your Wi-Fi upgraded.
That's actually a really good example, because in my village right now, every single pavement in the village has been dug up and a trench laid for fiber optic internet cables. Yeah. Right? Now, that as an infrastructure work is no less challenging than laying down a district heating system for the entire village.
Yeah.
So, and people talk about, oh, there's a disruption to the roads that this will cause. And yeah, it will cause a bit of disruption. My footpath was impassable for a few days. I had to cross the road to walk past it. Yeah. A few people had to move their car for a few days. Yeah. A few people had to negotiate with the company to say, no, you can't actually put the barrier there because that's my driveway. Right? And they had to move things around. So there was a bit of disruption. I'm not discounting it, but it wasn't a catastrophe. It's all happening quite smoothly. So we could be doing that kind of. But yeah, we need to get demand down. And that's not just for a cost thing. It's for a comfort thing. Even if you can afford your massive heating bill, you still don't really want to live in a cold and drafty house.
Mm. Or a house that's overheated as well. And this is quite a warm house. In the summer, it's quite cool, which is nice to be able to come in from the summer's heat and quite cool. But
Insulation works both ways.
So that's obviously the starting point, is not need as much of it in the first place. And that's within our gift, isn't it? Insulation is not part of what's reserved. So I keep coming back to this idea that you've planted in my mind of the sort of we're all shareholders and some kind of publicly funded heat company that we all have because we've all got a stake in it, so we could all. If not the Scottish Government, who does that kind of thing? Is it up to a group of individuals to get together and start talking about it? What, how do you in practice make these things happen?
It needs to be government level. It just needs to be, because if it's not, it's going to be local. It has to be local authority level, and they need empowered by the Scottish Government to do it, because they're under the same borrowing structures. If it's not going to be publicly owned, it's going to be privately owned, and that means profit extraction.
That almost circles us round to the, where we started, which was the SNP have agreed a motion for a publicly owned energy company. Yeah. If they're not able to do it because of what's in the Scotland Act and lack of borrowing, maybe that's the card that opens up the way of doing it. If you thought of it as a heating company, publicly owned heat company, rather than publicly owned energy company, I would be equally, I think it's the public owned bit that's so attractive, isn't it? It's exactly. The idea that it's ours. Yeah, that's an interesting a little way around the issue.
And remember that the barriers themselves are merely political. So this is a campaign that the Scottish Government could be waging against the UK Government to get those powers devolved or get them changed or work with the UK Government to make this happen. If Keir Starmer is the next Prime Minister and he really does want to transition energy, although he's dumped most of his plans, so it doesn't look likely. Let's say he didn't, then there could be negotiations with the Scottish and UK government to really make it clear that, yes, okay, you want to have this pan-Britain model of energy, and that works well for perhaps for the Great British Grid level project.
The Kent Coast.
Yeah, but it doesn't work in local communities. You know, Westminster just can't see the small villages that would be ideal for a local district heating network. So a lot of this also has to be devolved, give the powers to Scotland to make it happen.
Yeah, and communities, again, that is, in a way, that's sort of our untapped resource as well, because there's so many development trusts now are binding their feet, I think. I mean, our local ones... been looking at some very interesting things. So that presumably is entirely within the Scottish Government's gift. Any supporter can give to community organisations to do these things for them.
Even down to the level of telling onshore energy developers, like, as I say, the energy companies that are approaching farmers to put up solar panels on prime agricultural land, you could be saying, right, if you want to get planning permission for this, then you have to give the local community a 5 or 10% shareholder stake in the project. And that was actually part of Hamza Yusuf's leadership campaign. He was calling for communities to have more of a public stake in energy. He was calling for Scotland.
So a quick reminder from the leadership contest.
And Scotland has so much renewable potential, over 60,000 jobs in the green economy. But I don't want to just create the jobs. I want to make sure that when there's profit made from our renewables, that we take an equity stake in that. So the profit doesn't go just to the shareholders and dividends, it goes to the people. So we just not just harness the jobs, we make sure we, the people, get some of that profit too.
He kind of said that if there was a Scotland too, then he would demand that the Scottish Government had a 10% stake in it. Slightly unfortunate, the week he said that, Denmark announced that it was saying that its minimum public stake in energy projects was going up from 10% to 20%.
Shows it can be done, though.
It can be done, yeah. So, you could be saying onshore electricity, not just a community benefit fund, which is a few pittance that's hard to access. Local communities could become shareholders, mutual shareholders, via perhaps a community council or a development trust in the energy that's being generated around them.
And that would really strengthen our link to our own land and our own resources. And that concept that this is ours. I think
one of the things people do complain about wind turbines, and you're rightly so, they're a big change to the landscape. But what you see in places like the islands, where there is much, much stronger sense of community ownership in energy, it's a lot harder. It's easy to complain about that private company's wind turbine that's pulling all that money away from your community. It's a different prospect to look at it and say, that's mine. That's my wind turbine. That's ours. And it's providing electricity for our village. I get my dividend check every 6 months that gives me a discount on my energy use or something, something like that.
Yeah. National Heating Company joining up all these districts, these little community sharing best practice and all that. Yeah.
Exactly.
So we're not completely helpless. It just needs some coordination to get it going.
Coordination, obviously the capital, but most importantly, it needs the political will. It just needs the political direction to make it happen. We are starting to see some moves. One of the things that actually was a really good move from the Scottish Government, I'm not being entirely negative all this entire show, I promise, was they accepted our call for every local authority to start producing maps of where district heating systems could go. Every local authority now has to produce a heat network energy map. My own South Lanarkshire has produced one, but it's mostly focusing in the towns and almost completely ignored the villages. So that's something me and my energy colleagues are looking at the moment, because small villages are ideal for district heating systems. Yes. They're nice and compact. So it's progress. Small progress is progress nonetheless. So it's good to see that kind of thing. And we should be seeing, right, this is actually why we wanted to have a Scottish Energy Development Agency set up.
Yeah.
Because the role of that organisation, as distinct from the National Energy Company, would be to do this strategic work to identify where the next big the next energy project should go.
Yeah.
We created a model that had three prongs to it. The National Investment Bank provides the finance, it pays for the projects. The energy company points at the map and says the project should go here, and then the National Energy Company builds it in conjunction with the National Infrastructure Company that would help provide and train the workforce and sort out the supply chains and make sure that there's maximum benefit to Scotland in that, rather than farming it out to private companies.
Yeah.
So it's interesting that of those four organisations, we now have the National Investment Bank. It's not big enough, it's got restrictions, its missions are misguided, but it's there. We have the National Energy Development Agency. That was brought in as a compensation for the Scottish Government dropping their plans for an energy company. It's not doing much. It's not doing the right things, but it's there. The National Infrastructure Company is still technically on the government's docket as a policy to be developed. We haven't heard anything about it for a couple of years, not since Nicola Sturgeon left and Hamza Yousaf took over, but it's there. And then this National Energy Company is the one that's still that big political challenge. Mm-hmm. So when I talked about Wales being our most successful policy in terms of National Energy Company, that's not to discount that of the four components that we need to really get this going in Scotland, Commonweal has won three of them already. Yes. In at least some form. They need to be improved, they need to be made bigger and all that. But just that's that brilliant. One little more step, and then a bit of joined up thinking, a bit of strategy, and a bit of political will behind it, and that's when the Commonweal Energy Plan can really start beginning.
Well, what a fantastic positive note to end our discussion on. Thank you so much. That has been fascinating, and I could listen to you talk about this all day. But I'm sure you
could talk about it for weeks. So much more I missed.
And I love the fact that on your podcast that you're looking for activism is your theme, isn't it?
Yeah, the theme for the Commonweal Policy Podcast this year is Activate. So if you're in a community and you're doing an interesting thing, it could be a campaign, it could be a movement, it could be setting up your local energy company or buying into a local energy generator. And I've spoken to people who are doing precisely that. Whatever you're doing, I want to see someone doing something interesting in Scotland that maybe the rest of Scotland can't see because we don't have a media that looks at this kind of thing. Get in touch with me and I'll get you onto the podcast and we can chat about it.
Fantastic. There you go. So there's the challenge, folks. Get on it. And if you want to email Craig, you can get him craig@common.scot.
What struck you most from talking to him? I mean, obviously, there's Welsh-Scottish difference.
I felt we ended on a high note in the discussion, because having spent an hour going through all the things, the barriers, all the difficulties, everything we'd have to get over, at the end, Craig was saying, well, there's four main things need to be in place before Scotland can take some control over the electricity we generate. And three of them are already there. Yeah. And Commonweal are on the case. So I was left feeling a lot more positive, actually, about the fact that Wales is going forward on the basis of the design that Craig and Commonweal came up with. I think it is still quite encouraging that clearly there's value in what they've come up with. And in a way, we've got a blueprint happening in Wales, which, you know, it makes it easier maybe for Scotland to follow. But the other thing I was left with, though, is just this desperation to get on with it, because, you know, the idea that our renewable energy potential could be diverted to Westminster in the same way as the oil money has been is pretty horrifying. And although independence obviously opens a lot of doors, there are still things we could be doing now that we just absolutely should be getting on with.
Yeah, and I was struck that I think it was towards the end when Craig and yourself were saying that, you know, that yeah, there are barriers there still, but, you know, to be able to really get ahead, as you're suggesting, but those barriers are just political. They could be negotiated away, and I mean, they're not. Hopefully, by the end of the year, there'll be a different kind of government in Westminster, and maybe that can open doors on negotiating with a Labour Westminster government. Yeah, well, fingers crossed.
But there is one little interesting nugget I found out. This GB Energy that Keir Starmer wants to create and site in Scotland, if he Googles GB Energy, he'll see there is already a GB Energy based in Glasgow that already exists. So he's either going to have to spend a lot of money buying the name from them, or he's going to have to call it something else.
Yeah, well, good on them, whoever set it up.
Yeah.
Maybe they thought that one day Gordon Brown was going to set up an energy company, so they called it GB Energy.
Anyway, so there's a plug for the real GB Energy of Scotland. GB Energy.
I mean, my attention was caught when, you know, Craig in this episode was talking about, well, but actually ScotGov could have a heat energy company. There could be a Scottish heat company. So we are going to we're going to follow that up in various ways, aren't we? With a chat with Keith Baker about heat energy, how to conserve it, how to make it more renewable that we use, because mostly we heat our houses with gas at the moment. Myself and Marion Robertson, who's one of our occasional indie podcasters, she and I are putting together something on a very small scale houses. How do you make your house better? Who does what? And we're putting that together. So that's coming up for the future over the next couple of months.
Yeah. So for now, we'll just say thanks very much for our guest. And thanks to everybody for listening. And don't forget, new podcast out every Friday. Don't forget to subscribe. And if you like what we're doing, it'd be great if you could leave us some feedback or a positive review or something like that, because that all helps. But anyway, we'll catch you later. Bye now.
Bye.